Hi, I'm Haley Brennan, and you're listening to the New Narratives in the History of Philosophy podcast. Today, I'll be talking to Jackie Broad about Mary Estelle.
My name is Jackie Broad, and I'm in the philosophy department at Monash University, Melbourne, in Australia. And my research specialisation is in early modern women's philosophy.
So, Jackie, I always start off by asking everyone, how did you get interested in studying this early modern women's philosophy?
Sure. Well, I did my undergraduate years at the University of Tasmania back in the early 1990s. And I went through a degree in philosophy. It was a very good degree. It was a training in history of philosophy. But I came out at the end and I had a double major in English and philosophy. And in English, I studied the Romantics, and we looked at women, any number of women. We looked at Mary Shelley, we looked at Wollstonecraft, we looked at Jane Austen, and so on. But in philosophy, through my entire three-year degree, we hadn't looked at a single woman philosopher. So at the end of it, you know, some of us were looking at each other saying, well, where were all the women? And I wanted to go on. I had to decide between English and philosophy, and so I took a gap year between my undergraduate degree and what in Australia we call the honours year, which is sort of a gateway into postgraduate studies. And I was deciding what will I do. When I was deciding what I would do, I was reading The Female Eunuch, as you do, which is, as you may know, it's written by very famous Australian feminist, Germaine Greer, who's also well versed in 18th century women writers. And she had a quote from someone called Mary Astle, okay? And the quote was something like, to criticise a woman for losing an argument is like criticising a man for losing a fight with one hand tied behind his back. And I'm like, oh, this is very interesting. Sounds like it's coming from a philosophical point of view, it's about argument. And the quote was from 1696. I'm like, right, who's this Mary Astle person? Mm-hmm. And I looked her up and for the first time ever saw those two words put together, woman philosopher. There was an entry in Ethelyn Kersey's book calling Mary Astle a woman philosopher. Not only that, also calling her a Cartesian. And I was like, this is it for me. This is the woman I want to study. I've never heard of her before, but clearly she's working in the 17th century, which, you may know, it's a very exciting period in philosophy. It's when a number of the great philosophical figures emerge and great modern philosophical ideas start to arise. So I went from there and I pursued Mary Astle for my honours project, and it's just been sort of gathering my momentum since then.
Well, so let's talk a little bit more about Mary Astle specifically. Yeah. So I guess what drew you to her other than the first woman you encountered in philosophy, which is a virtue in itself?
Well, but that's a really good question, because I could have gone to her books and gone, oh, I don't understand this. But the fact is, when you go to one of the first books she wrote, which is The Serious Proposal to the Ladies, once you get over the kind of alienness and the foreignness of the language, you realise it's a big consciousness-raising book. It's a feminist consciousness-raising book. And any young woman in her 20s who's just read Germaine Greer who comes and reads that goes, whoa, 400 years ago, 300 years ago, women were writing about this. You know, you think of feminism as being a rather recent phenomenon, a 20th century phenomenon. It wasn't at all. Like, whenever women have suffered sexism and suffered from misogyny and oppression, there have always been women fighting back. And here was Mary Astle in the 17th century with this beautifully written book, this eloquent call to arms, although only figuratively a call to arms, to women to rise up and to effect their own emancipation, if you like, through the study of philosophy. So that was very exciting. The other thing about Mary Astle is she's really prickly. Like, you can imagine, like, you just wouldn't have wanted to meet her, because she's quite savage. She's quite sharp and incisive in her critiques of men. And that comes through. It comes through in her published works. And it wasn't until later when I started looking at her manuscripts and her letters, and it also comes through. This personality, this not putting up with anything, calling injustices and injuries for what they are to women. And I like that about her too, because I'm kind of not someone that doesn't like to speak their mind. I like to rub people up the wrong way, but she did. And it's great that she was like that, because otherwise she wouldn't have written this feminist consciousness raising work if she hadn't been that kind of angry, prickly kind of person. So I kind of like that about her too, actually,
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to say, you said I wouldn't want to meet her, but she sounds good.
You like to have a conversation. As long as she wasn't directing anything.
Yes, exactly.
Against you.
Come on, your side.
That's right. I'm a woman. Hey, a woman.
That's right. Yeah. So you mentioned, A Serious Proposal to the Ladies. I mean, the title also speaks to this, but it's a feminist kind of call to arms. Yeah. So I read the introduction to your book on Mary Astell. Yeah. And it also sounds like she not only was in trying to invoke the women in her world to study philosophy, but also trying to write a philosophy that appealed to these ladies. Is that true, fair to say?
I think it's fair to say. Well, the funny thing about Astell is, even though, like, all those years ago, back in 1993 it was, when I first heard her called a Cartesian and called a woman philosopher, not many people have gone in there and tried to draw out the philosophy. It's there. It's very obvious. There are all these references to Descartes, to Malebranche, to Locke. She was very much seeing herself as a philosopher and writing and engaging with the philosophy of the time. I was attracted to that, but it takes a bit of drawing out. And this is the thing about the women philosophers of the past. You kind of, perhaps not so much now, but back then, you came to them raw. You just came to raw materials. There wasn't a history of interpretation. Not a long one, anyway. There were certainly people working on these figures. Ruth Perry is a big name in Astell studies. But she wasn't a philosopher. You have to start from, not start from scratch, but you have to situate what Astell says, for example, in the context of the times. In my case, I had to do a lot of background reading on the figures that she was discussing, who, funnily enough, aren't really major figures today. I mean, they were forces to be reckoned with in the 17th century, but who today has heard of figures like John Norris and Henry Moore and so on? She was engaging with popular figures of the time. So the challenge there was to not look at Astell through the lens of what interests philosophers today, although that was part of the project, but also to try to step back and say, well, what interested the intellectual thinkers of her time? What were the major issues of her time? And how does she fit into that tradition as well? So that was one of the challenges of looking at this work, in my case, with very little background in early modern philosophy, like 20 years ago.
So what were some of the major issues that she was grappling with?
Well, a lot of them are very religious. So you can't ignore that. I'm an atheist, and so to me it wasn't terribly attractive, but I couldn't ignore it because there's this kind of evangelism in her work. I mean, I talk about there being a feminist consciousness raising in her writing, but there's also a kind of religious consciousness raising going on too. It's like, I want you to be happy, she says to women. I want you to learn how to be good and happy. And how do you do that? Well, you study philosophy, but you also study religion, and you should be inspired by your faith to obtain happiness, not just in this life, but in the life that comes after too. And so you have to situate a number of her recommendations about how women can pull themselves up by their bootstraps to attain happiness. You have to read a lot of those recommendations in light of her religious purpose. So a lot of her philosophy is put to the service of a religious end, like the obtainment of salvation, I guess, is the way you would put it. Mm-hmm. So that was issues. But I'm going to come back and look at, like, issues that have endured, issues that still preoccupy us today. They're there in her work, despite the deeply religious tone of her works. So those issues are, how can I be good and happy? I mean, it's perennial. What kind of practical strategies can I put in place? Mm-hmm. How can I avoid error? How can I pursue the good and affirm the true? It's questions like that. And of course, it's a Cartesian program. It's about trying to rise above your senses, rise above the body and the passions. But It's a sophisticated kind of Cartesianism which recognises that the body is not separate from the mind in the human being, is it? It's to obtain virtue, to obtain happiness, you have to recognise that you're an embodied subject, that you're subject to certain appetites, hunger and thirst, certain sensations from the sensory organs, but also certain passions, love, hate, anger. So to be a moral agent, to pursue moral ends, you have to recognise you're an embodied subject. So those are questions that she asked too. How as an embodied human being can I obtain these moral and religious ends?
Well, I mean, that's fantastic. Descartes was probably asking very similar questions religiously, but, refused to engage with what...
We get handed down this view of Descartes. Not so much a caricature. I mean, certainly not a caricature in scholars who, especially historians of philosophy, look at Descartes carefully. They see Descartes for all his nuances and all his variations from the caricature, but then... On the other hand, especially the kind of undergraduate conception we get of Descartes, we get a certain caricature as being a certain way. Mm-hmm. But Mary Astell doesn't have that kind of baggage of 300 years of interpreting Descartes behind her. She sees Descartes not as like this grand father of modern philosophy, but as one amongst many very important figures in the time. Someone who may not be and may not have all the answers, may not be that great genius that we thought he was. So she can actually take quite a critical stance towards Descartes as well. So that's the other interesting thing. So you get a different, shift in perspective on the history of philosophy by studying these women philosophers. And people that we think are important today were just one amongst many rival candidates for the next greatest thing.
I mean, we've mentioned Descartes, and obviously, as you said, Descartes holds this place in prominence in the way we study philosophy today. But you also mentioned Henry Moore, John Norris.
Right.
Was she in correspondence with these philosophers who we may have lost?
So this is the great thing, too, that I love about studying Mary Astell, is you get a conception of the history of philosophy again as a collaborative, cooperative enterprise, where people were writing to one another, working out ideas. And so Astell, certainly she was in correspondence with John Norris, who himself was in correspondence with Henry Moore. So she's kind of like one removed from Henry Moore. In fact, he was dead by the time she started writing. She still would have been quite a young woman when he died, and she certainly wasn't in intellectual circles at the time. So she sort of cut her teeth on philosophy in correspondence with Norris. She does raise quite sharp objections, quite clever objections to some of his views. She is grappling through Norris with another figure of the time, Nicholas Malebranche. And now he was certainly a force to be reckoned with in the 17th century, especially in 17th century England. We think of Descartes today as one of the most dazzling figures, but Malebranche was at the height of his fame when Astell was writing to Norris. He was a huge figure. He was greatly admired by women. Because he had, unlike Descartes, he had a lot to say about women in his text. And it was strangely contradictory. He said that women were capable of anything. Mm-hmm. They had minds like men, that they were capable of using those minds to train themselves, to affirm the true and pursue the good. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, he said that women's brain fibres were curiously delicate. They were frightened by the meowing of a cat, and that they were easily startled and easily distracted and couldn't comprehend anything abstract. And so Astell was reading Malebranche. She was inspired by him. Her peers were Mary Chudley, Catherine Coburn. There were a number of women philosophers who were reading Malebranche because, like I said, his fame at the time was absolutely dazzling. He was someone everyone was writing about. But there's this curious contradiction in him where he's saying these things about women that seem to be paradoxical. On the one hand, they're capable of anything. On the other hand, their brain fibres are too delicate to cope with abstract thought. But I think she's on the side that sees him as saying, well, women could do anything, but unfortunately the way things are now in terms of their training in meditation and study and so on, they can't get there. But then, so... The same is true of a lot of men, according to Malebranche. A lot of people will just be mediocre. They will not get there. They will fail to aspire to the true and the good because it's just the way human nature is. We live in these bodies that tyrannize over us, that dominate us, that enslave us, and we can't break free of them to pursue the truth. So that was kind of part and parcel of Malebranche. And I think she read him carefully. She read him carefully in English translation. And when she was writing to Norris, all those English translations, there were two of The Search After Truth, were coming out and everybody was reading him. Women were reading him.
The quote you started with, where you said that you found of Estelle, where she said that asking a woman to, or I'm going to butcher it.
But criticizing a woman for losing an argument, like criticizing a man for losing a fight with both hands tied behind his back.
I mean, it sounds like she was picking up on these threads that say, you know, women don't have the right tools to be able to explore abstract thought.
That's right. Yeah. So that's a good point. So she gets that from Malebranche, and she also gets it from Descartes. Mm-hmm. I should say, Dumaine Greer, great scholar, but she misattributed that.
Oh no!
Actually, from another woman at the time, Judith Drake. Okay. And now that we know more about Astor, you can go back and read the work from which it was taken. It's called An Essay in Defense of the Female Sex. And you can see they come from completely different perspectives. Drake from a Lockean point of view, Astor from a Cartesian rationalist point of view. But they're both committed to the same ends, which is get women educated. So it's one thing they draw out of these philosophies is just like the absolutely essential role of education for enabling women to live up to what they call the dignity of their nature. Okay, so we don't talk about dignity so much these days, but it was a huge concept at the time, and it kind of captures this idea that human beings have a certain status. They're better than animals, okay? And the ontological hierarchy, they're above animals, they're above rocks. Why? Well, they're kind of closer to God.
Yeah.
They've got free will, they've got reason. They're not just capable of sensation. They're much more than that. So they have this higher dignity. And as a result, they also have this intrinsic worth. Like, all human beings have this intrinsic value by virtue of the fact that they are, again, like God, and not so much like animals. And so, but at the time, of course, women were still being grouped like somewhere in between men and animals, you know, not quite reaching the heights of dignity that men had. And the wonderful thing about Cartesian philosophy is that it brought about this seismic shift in thinking. We are, all human beings, radically different from animals. How so? Well, we have this capacity for rational judgment that no animal ever shows signs of having. And you know, he has this famous, for better or worse, he has this famous linguistic test and his behavioural test to show this. And so that shift in thinking enabled women to come in and say, right, there's no in-between men and animals. Women are equal in terms of dignity with men. But the problem is this, the contingent historical circumstances have meant that women are not educated to use those tools that they've been given by God to lead them to perfection. They're not being educated to use them well. Custom leads to them using their free will to affirm obscure and confused ideas instead of the clear and distinct ideas of the mind. They need training. They don't need to read a lot of books. They just need to read good ones that are going to give them a method that they can use in all avenues of life, and that's a Cartesian insight too. So I think that's why Astor says, right, we need to get women out of society just temporarily. We need to send them to a retreat. We need to send them to an all-female academy where for once in their lives they can reflect upon what they've taken for granted, what they've been told to believe, and that they can come to own their beliefs and values and interests as their own after going through this process of critical reflection, using good methods. But to get there, they need that education. And it's not just a rudimentary primary school education. It has to be a higher education. So that's when she came in with a proposal. And her famous proposal to the ladies is a proposal to set up an all-female academy in England, where women can study philosophy and religion and improve on those natural tools that God has given them to lead them to Him. Or to happiness, let's say, if we want to be a bit more secular about it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Was there anyone, so she was engaging obviously with people like Norris, from a distance she was engaging with Cartesian philosophy. Was anyone critically engaging with Estelle? Was it a back and forth?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So again, one of the things I had to work out, like coming to Astle, knowing there wasn't a great deal of interpretation of philosophy in the context of the times in which she wrote and so on, so I did have to work out like who engaged with her and who she was engaging with too. And one of the really lovely engagements that occurs in her career is with another woman philosopher. I was like, this is great. Like the 17th century, especially the late 17th century, is the era of great philosophical antagonisms. You know, people writing massive works, just yeah. like viciously attacking one another and so on. And in the context of this, particularly in the reception of Locke's essay, which was hugely controversial at the time, we see a debate between women going on. Mm-hmm. And so Astle engaged, perhaps somewhat inadvertently, with a colleague of Locke's called Damaris Masham. Mm-hmm. Astle wrote her serious proposal to the ladies and also at the same time published her correspondence with Norris. So as I said, this was her philosophical training grounds when she cut her teeth in philosophical controversy. And at the end of that private correspondence, Norris said, can I publish it? And she said, well, I really don't want you to, but it's okay. There's always a bit of protest going on in the preface. But it was very much a polished work. I think it was very much presented for a public audience. And so it came out, but then Damaris Masham, like within a year, wrote this, I won't say vicious attack, but it certainly was taken as being vicious. But she wrote an attack on the Norris Astle correspondence, but she also wrote an attack on Norris more generally. And Norris was saying, just to give you a brief version, he was saying that basically human beings should withdraw their love from other people and devote all their love and desire to God alone, because this is what true religion and true moral duty requires from them. And Masham just shook her head and wrote back and said, well, this is just impractical, isn't it? Because we're all going to love other people anyway. It's in our nature to do so. And we're all going to feel terribly inadequate and a lot of people will be driven to despair as a result. This is not a practical philosophy. She had seemingly had Astle in her sights too. Mm-hmm. She never names her because Astle always wrote anonymously. Okay. Although it seems to have been an open secret who she was, because Locke, with whom Masham lived mm-hmm. for many years, bought a copy of the Astle Norris letters and the proposal for Masham. And when he wrote it in his journals, he was a bit OCD, absolutely everything down, he attributed the proposal to Astle, even though it was not known who wrote mm-hmm. the work. So he must have known. He must have been in circles that knew. Yeah. And so I think when Masham refers to a young author biased by the affectation of novelty, that's how she refers to the correspondent of Norris, she can't have been referring to anyone else except Astle. Mm-hmm. And so Astle saw many of these, much of Masham's critique is directed against her as well as Norris. And so many years later, she wrote a work imaginatively titled called The Christian Religion, which takes issue with this and fights back and says, you've misunderstood me. This was just a kind of, she's almost suggesting like, oh, this love of God's really just a psychotherapeutic technique to help us treat other people with a true love of benevolence. To truly wish well towards other people and not desire them in a jealous, kind of possessive kind of way. So Masham engaged with Astle, to answer your question. Masham engaged with her. She was adored. She was feted. She was a famous figure. Mm-hmm. Even up until her death, people were regarding her as a celebrity, regarding her as someone with a well-deserved fame. We don't know it. We don't know that today. We don't know that this figure was once so popular. She was almost completely forgotten after she died in 1731. But at the time, people were, yes, they were writing about her ideas. Often, they would just refer to her as the author of the proposal mm-hmm. to the ladies. Daniel Defoe refers to her work in a work he wrote about suggestions for a female academy. Mm-hmm. John Evelyn praised her. His wife, Mary Evelyn, praised her as well. She was generally, she was also engaged with, of course, in political pamphlets at the time, because she too wrote a number of anonymous political pamphlets on the Tory side, and so Whigs engaged with her too. I can name many people, but again, this has been one of the great pleasures in study, mm-hmm. as you see that here's this figure forgotten until the 20th century, who at her time shone very brightly and was someone who other people worked out their ideas in connection to. So she was very much part of the formation and development of modern philosophy as we see it. Maybe a small part to some extent, but certainly not a small part with regards to feminist philosophy of the period. And that's the point to keep remembering. Her influence in terms of her feminist thought had a huge impact on female contemporaries as well. They engaged with her, they built on what she wrote. So please remember that.
Do you have any suggestions for people who want to find out more, not only about someone like Estelle, but there's lots of figures we've mentioned throughout the course of this conversation that don't feature into our big, canonical study of early modern philosophy.
Well, yeah, for sure. I mean, I can only recommend my own kind of bumbling, accidental way of coming to study these women. Is that if you do have an interest, I mean, to begin with the footnotes, that's where we always begin. Start mining them for sources, for primary sources and secondary sources. And also to keep an open mind, because one of the reasons Estelle, I think, was forgotten, although I'm sure there are many reasons why women philosophers of the past are not remembered, and perhaps many of them have to do with sexism. But one of the reasons is that in the 19th century, you see this shift take place in philosophy where it's demarcated quite markedly from religion. Mm-hmm. And my advice to new scholars would be just take the religion in your stride. When you read Locke, when you read Descartes, mm-hmm. when you read a number of these figures from the period, you'll be struck by that religiosity, trust me. It's just that we get this training, which means that the big issues, personal identity, primary, secondary qualities, they jump out at us amidst some of the religiosity. Mm-hmm. And I think the same needs to be done for women philosophers. I mean, so that we can see what their enduring relevance is. What's mm-hmm. their enduring relevance? And so my advice there would be to look for those things that do interest you, but also to keep an open mind and to look at the issues from their perspective. Because while they might not come up with the same answers to the questions that puzzle us most today, there's some lovely ideas in there, some ideas that we've almost lost through time because we don't have we don't have certain religious baggage, but also we don't have certain cultural norms and so on that they had in their time. So to look for ideas of enduring relevance would be one suggestion, but the other would be to keep an open mind for different ways of looking at things, because the past, as they say, is a foreign country. They do things differently there, but they don't just do things differently there, they think things differently there. Mm-hmm. And that's wonderful for coming to current philosophical debates with fresh perspectives, like historically informed perspectives.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. This was fantastically interesting and wonderful, and obviously I need to, gives me so much more to read every time I have one of these conversations. So thank you.
Well, thank you. It was a great pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the New Narratives in the History of Philosophy podcast. The New Narratives project and podcast are funded by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada. In the spirit of the project, the music for the podcast is 17th century female composer Elizabeth Claude Jacquet de la Guerre's Sonata No. 2 in D major, performed on the violin by Pizzeria Armonice. For more information about the project and for future episodes, please visit our website, newnarrativesinphilosophy.net, and follow us on Facebook. We look forward to discussing all these new figures and ideas with you.